Thank you so much, Professor Bachchan, for that amazing introduction. Let me start by welcoming all of you, ladies and gentlemen, members of the All Souls College, the university community, and guests from near and far. It is impossible to overstate my gratitude for the invitation to deliver this year's Slate Lectures. I am honored by this acknowledgement by my peers of my contribution to the field of art history, but it is not lost on me that my presence here today marks a major milestone for scholars of African descent, who until now had been absent from the hallowed roster of Slate Lecturers at Oxford. For these two reasons, I will dedicate each of my six lectures to individuals and community of people who have contributed in various ways to my journey as a scholar and art historian, that is, people who I could not have traveled this long, improbable journey from the University of Nigeria and Nsukka, where I took my first art and art history classes in the 1980s, to this podium here at Oxford. I therefore dedicate my introductory lecture to my dear friend and departed brother, Okwue Nwezor, with whom I started, while a practicing artist, my earliest forays into art historical scholarship in the early 1990s. I offer this lecture to the many years we spent together on diverse scholarly and curatorial projects, the long nights we shared arguing over ideas big and small, and our long and unlikely journey as child survivors of the Biafran War to the world of art and art scholarship. I also dedicate this talk to the late Sydney Littlefield Casfair, my advisor at Emory University, who not only helped me transition to art history, but also was my ardent academic cheerleader, mentor, and friend. I'm grateful to both Mr. Nwezor and Professor Casfair for the profundity of their contributions to the making of the field of modern and contemporary African art scholarship and for the friendship we shared. And with that, I turn to my topic for today. So let me sketch the problem I hope to examine in these lectures, in the course of which I will focus on the work of five African artists during the second half of the 20th century, a period marked by political decolonization and the emergence of charismatic, powerful leaders that I am calling the big men. By examining the relationship of art and strongman politics, I will engage in extended meditation on the politics of power and art in post-colonial Africa, and hopefully lay bare art's critical ambitions, as well as its limits and possibilities as a vehicle for critique of and resistance to regimes of domination in 20th century Africa. I must confess, though, that I have no idea whether the audience finds the title of this lecture clear, as I hope, or as opaque, as I suspect. But I assume that most of us here have at least some reasonable idea about who I mean by African artists. If not, I offer you the same response Chinua Achebe gave decades ago to the question of who is the African writer. And as he put it, I quote, "It is partly a matter of passports, of individual volition, and particularly of seeing from the African perspective, and of seeing Africa as a geographical expression and a metaphysical landscape," unquote. What Achebe tells us simply is that who is an African artist is a complicated thing that depends on many variables, and I'll leave it at that. So I will be doing three things today. First, to examine at some length the big man as a trope and figure of power in post-colonial Africa. Second, to consider how the topic of these lectures relate to our understanding of modern and contemporary African art history. And third, to briefly comment on my five case studies. Well, there's no fixed definition of the big man as a trope, though various synonyms such as strongman, autocrat, big shot, warlord, dictator, they occur in both popular and scholarly literature. And although it is a well-traveled and familiar way to describe an astonishingly broad spectrum of men who wield all manners and scales of power, it is the American anthropologist Marshall Sahlins that in 1963 described the term as we know it today. In his research on Polynesia and Melanesia, Sahlins observed that whereas the Polynesian groups with established political structures had chiefs at the helm of their clan formations, in Melanesia, on the other hand, marked by loose kingship residential groups, the leader figure is the big man. He tells us that the Polynesian chief is the more universally familiar character whose claim to power is guaranteed and justified by well-established system of succession and assertion of authority based on individual qualification or lineage, as with the Brits. The chief thus embodies normative sociopolitical order and is the guarantor or defender of a community's ideals, its internal cohesion, and its relationship with the world beyond its borders. On the other hand, the Melanesian big man occupies the position of leadership within his community, not so much through the authority of tradition as by direct assertion of his personal ambition and the ability to eliminate other claimants while dominating the rest of society through self-serving coercive power. And to do this, the big man must show and perform this power, not just by sheer charisma, but also by the appropriate deportment of his body to make obvious its function as vessel and locus of power. As is often the case, he must not only exercise power by concentrating and controlling its modes of expression, it helps if he's a large, physically powerful, and domineering man. For it is in this way that this brand of personalist authority is seamlessly and vigorously expressed and perceived. Certainly, Sahlins was describing a figure of power and authority that is a product of Melanesian sociopolitical power and structure That is, because they were organized in small autonomous communities, they did not develop elaborate, long-standing traditions of state control. Such society implied was thus amenable to unregulated succession processes and the rise to authority of whoever can claim and assert coercive power. That is, whoever can become the big man. One way to describe the Melanesian big man to someone familiar with early 20th century English literature, and more specifically, George Orwell's Animal Farm, is that he might have been that noxious, cunning, ambitious, brutal, power-hungry character, the mighty Napoleon. However, there's no reason to think that the big man figure is an invention of Melanesia, and I must confess that I'm not the first to identify this character in African societies and in the modern nations mostly created by European powers in the 20th century Africa. In fact, I have relied on the work of the Malawian literary scholar Deborah Nyangulu and the Cameroonian historian Achille Mbembe in my thinking about the big man in Africa. In her study of the big man in the African novel, Nyangulu argues that they are often corrupt, violent, rich, and without regard to the rule of law, and that they feature in both major and subordinate narrative positions, with the body becoming the privileged site of representing and performance of their power. We have in Idi Amin of Uganda, who frequently boasted of his boxing prowess, in Yoweri Museveni, also of Uganda, who at 78 might be the king, the country's push-up king. And in the South African president, Jacob Zuma, his mastery of Zulu manly dance as fine examples of the performative aspect of the African sovereign big manhood. Indeed, the very idea of identifying the big man with a particular type of influential figure with the context of within the context of the colonial and post-colonial Africa helps us to understand the workings of power and authority in both democratic and autocratic political systems in modern Africa. For in this Africa, the distinction Salins makes between the chief and the big man collapses, in the sense that the chief performs his authority by drawing on the characteristics of the big man, and vice versa. The histories of African kingdoms and empires before the coming of the European colonizers are replete with chiefs and kings who demonstrated their claim to authority by physically or symbolically asserting their authority through suppression of all perceived or real opposition, by showing themselves as the finest specimens of manhood, and by presenting or representing their bodies as sites of mystical powers and as the body politic. In recognition of this fact, but also especially because it was administratively convenient, European powers frequently relied on the coercive and despotic powers of chiefs, kings, and emirs to facilitate the establishment and maintenance of the colonial state. Even in fiercely republican societies such as the Igbo of southeastern Nigeria, that for the most part did not have chiefs or big men, the British invented what they called warrant chiefs by giving authority to usually the nastiest and most dreaded men they could find in each autonomous community. In fact, it is the colonial reliance on these newfangled chiefs that led to the Aba Women's War of 1929. And that forced the Colonial Office in London to abolish the Warren Chief system. But the point here is that the colonial regime in both the Igbo and other examples created the big man chief who relied on the colonizer's power to assert his authority, yet had all the self-serving characteristics of the big man. The point here, though, is that the widespread tendency of these modern big men to appropriate and deploy signifiers of African cultural traditions and the open or tacit investment of official authority on local agents of colonial and neocolonial governments ensured the normalization of this figure in the modern African state. In one of the more memorable descriptions of the big man African president, the American writer Norman Mailer, while visiting the Democratic Republic of Congo, then Republic of Zaire, to cover the 1974 Rumble in the Jungle boxing match between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman, says this of Mobutu Sese Seko, the country's ruler. And here's the stadium with the big poster of Mobutu Sese Seko dominating the stadium where the match was taking place. And so here's what he says, that Mobutu is the chieftain of the country and a king. It's part of the vital force to be resplendent. They will respect him less if his expenses were not larger than life. He's the leader of the nation, so a modern equivalent of the president, dictator, monarch, emperor, the chosen of God, and le roi soleil, all in one. How remarkable it is to compare Mailer's description of Mobutu Sese Seko with Sir Lindsay's characterization of the Melanesian big man who he says seems so bourgeois, so reminiscent of the free enterprising, rugged individual of our own heritage, meaning American heritage. He combines with an ostensible interest in the general welfare a more profound measure of self-interest, cunning, and economic calculation. His every public action is designed to make a competitive and invidious comparison with others to show a standing above the product of his own personal manufacture. I shall return to Mobutu Sese Seko in my last lecture, but for the moment, I should note that Mailer captures a fundamental aspect of the African big man, which is that he relies on and harnesses every available source of authority, whether secular or religious, traditional or modern, to personalize governmentality. So Idi Amin of Uganda, a man of great hulk who prided himself as a boxer, in his quest for full control of the economy, expelled tens of thousands of Asian Ugandans in 1972, but only after God spoke to him in a dream. And he made European agents and diplomats treat him as they would their own king. As you can see the image at the upper right. I should note that while the big man might flourish in and perpetuate poorly regulated political systems, he can as easily thrive in democracies, as in apartheid South Africa, in spite of established checks and balances, by inventing new and infinite ways of stretching and bending them to his will, often invoking alternative yet familiar bases of power legitimation. What we have then in many instances is the self-serving race signification, transmogrification, and redeployment of chiefly and tradition-sanctioned authority by big men at the helm of the post-colonial nation. To this class, national politics thus is a tool for consolidating and channeling state resources in the service of their personal glorification. To them, the formal mechanisms of governance, whether democratic or autocratic, are only effective or meaningful to the extent that they support the transformation of the nation into a zone of unchallenged, if inherently unstable, authority. But how is it possible in the context of the modern post-colonial state that the big men at the apex of national power transaction are able to thrive, or at the very least survive, sometimes for decades, many achieving great longevity in office despite their dismal records? I will need more time than this lecture allows to scratch the surface of this important question. However, Achille Mbembe has advanced a thesis on what he calls the banality of power in the post-colony that might be insightful. In trying to understand post-colonial power relations, he argues against easy binaries such as subjection versus autonomy, domination versus resistance, proposing instead that an intimate tyranny links the ruler and the ruled, just as obscenity is the very condition of state power. And he uses the term commandement, that is, the much despised figure of colonial authority, to represent the post-colonial authoritarian, noting that this character seeks to institutionalize himself in order to achieve legitimation and hegemony in the form of a fetish. Combined with the description of the African post-colony as characterized by a distinctive art of improvisation and by a tendency to excess and disproportion, what we have then is a socio-political setting in which both the authoritarian ruler and the citizenry are engaged in a convivial relationship in which we do not have one regulated public space, but multiple domains of discordance. In such a space, even the most excessive, obscene exercise of power by the authoritarian figure is deflected, repurposed, and resignified, in part because even the bureaucratized state machinery still lacks the capacity to fully control subjects that simultaneously simulate adherence to and support of the autocrat while relying on modes of popular speech and critical practices found in the culture to unmake and ridicule the autocrat's power play. And part of what I'll be doing in the subsequent lectures is to show how visual artists involved in these complicated response to post-colonial authority by adopting various modes of what we might call visual speech. In case, as I suspect you're wondering the point of this detour to Mbembe, let me make two relevant points. First, he allows us to see authoritarian leaders of post-colonial Africa in their tendency to build officialdom's edifices, yet compromise them at will for the sole purpose of vulgar self-magnification, as product of societies that, fresh from the traumatic systematization of official violence in the colonial era, see the relationship of the populace and authority as antagonistic play and intimate tyranny. Second, the people's apparent willingness to tolerate and support autocratic regimes is only so because they have developed informal mechanisms for living with a system rooted in a colonial ontology that normalized official tyranny. But how do we explain the prevalence and the unique longevity of African strongmen and big men of power, considering that a fifth of them have been in power for more than 20 years? To this, I suggest that a key factor is, as noted earlier, the autocrat penchant for co-opting traditional chieftaincy institutions and authority with which the populace have cultural and emotional affinity, thus guaranteeing some measure of support from segments of the population to whom these traditional institutions remain important. Thus, for all their claims to political modernity, a good number of Africa's autocrats and charismatic leaders, from Mzee Jomo Kenyatta to Ghana's Osagyefo Kwame Nkrumah, from Zaire's Mobutu Sese Seko to even Muammar Gaddafi of Libya, they all presented themselves to the populations through their fashion, behavior, and rhetoric as chiefly figures whose power is sanctioned by indigenous traditions, though no doubt enforced by state security and bureaucracy. I must admit, however, that the range of political figures and contexts covered in this lecture and the lecture series, including Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, Hendrik Verwoerd of South Africa, Al Nimieri of Sudan, Ibrahim Babangida of Nigeria, and Mobutu Sese Seko of Zaire, are significant enough that I need to clarify what qualifies them for the big man club. I had earlier invoked other terms such as strongman, autocrat, and dictator, and I've referred to Mbembe's commandment to describe the brand of post-colonial African leadership with which I'm concerned in these lectures. Yet none of these terms are capacious enough to account for the variety of political contexts, individual characters, and public perceptions of these leaders, nor do they substantially ground them within the African sociocultural experience. As we shall see, Nimieri did not have Nasser's charisma, yet survived multiple coups d'etat. Verwoerd's South Africa was a democratic racist state. Babangida helmed a classic military dictatorship, while Nasser and Mobutu seized power as military officers, but soon established one-party autocracies. And whereas Nasser spent much of his political capital on pan-Arabist ideology and the non-aligned movement, Mobutu invested his in an empire of stupendous corruption. Moreover, the decadent personalization of state power characteristic of Mbembe's commandment might have applied to Mobutu, but not quite to Nasser and Verwoerd. My point is that none of these usual terms are conceptually open and contextually specific enough to capture the diversity of characters such as the five that I will be discussing in these lectures in the way that the idea of the big man does. Moreover, the big man as a trope is a way of gendering the particular form of power in post-colonial Africa wielded exclusively by men who inherited national governance from colonial regimes. Yet the brand of power associated with them, at once self-serving, personalist, and frequently connected to perhaps even exploitative of aspects of indigenous and cultural traditions, is such that it is not exclusive to any specific religious, ethnic, or socioeconomic class. In other words, the big man phenomenon is not an aberration, nor is it alien to the imaginations and desires and interests of regular folks who, in moments of aspirational projection, wish to access power, while doing so, expect sympathy and support from a section of their imagined community. Indeed, what we are calling regular folk include a vast range of actors that I want to call the everyday small letter big men, who claim power and manipulate it within their own zones of influence, be it the university, the government office, the town union, or municipality. It is the ubiquity of these small big men in the post-colony that not only naturalizes the spectacular capital letter big men who might more easily be recognized as dictators and strong men at the helm of the nation state. To this point, Mbembe has also argued that ordinary citizens as subject of the dictator internalize the authoritarian epistemology to the point where they reproduce it themselves in all the minor circumstances of everyday life. But let me note that he is only partially right. For in the post-colony, I want to suggest, the citizenry cannot be construed as simply subject of the sovereign, who himself could neither establish an efficient administrative state nor even full command of whatever stands for national bureaucracy. And rather than think of the citizenry as learning the authoritarian epistemology of the big men, I would argue that, as in the case of the Melanesian big man, it is the lack of established systems of power management and succession that serves as the substrate for the growth of big men whose qualification for the top position is the ability to assert themselves and coerce others to stand down for the manifestation of their personal ambition. It is therefore the very nature of the post-colonial state in Africa, structurally weak, yet resourced with technologies of violence, that feeds the authoritarian epistemology shared by the sovereign at the helm of the state bureaucracy and the non-sovereign big men, such as the diverse characters Nyangulu identifies in the novels of Achebe, Aikwe Ama, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, Usman Semben, and Emmanuel Dongala. In my fifth lecture, the work of Obiora Odechukwu in Nigeria will offer us a view of the impact on the masses of the socio-cultural power of the everyday and the sovereign big men. Earlier, I had inferred that the African big man is in part the product of colonial governmentality, no less because imperial regimes cared more about efficiency and taxation, as well as pacification of the colonized, and thus favored the African version of the disruptive, self-centered political figure Salins identified in the decentralized polities of Melanesia. However, the sovereign big men of post-colonial Africa, with the nation's resources at their disposal, amped up their power by feeding on the Cold War rivalries of the NATO and Soviet alliances. These post-imperial, post-war powers, Cold War powers, in many cases, abetted the ambitions of the anti-democratic, corrupt, and despotic leaders in Africa, which in turn caused the proliferation of such characters and the epidemic of coup d'etat in the 1960s and 70s, as well as the widespread political instability and stagnation of democratic processes during the decades covered in these lectures. Consider, for instance, that Jean Bedel Bokassa of Central African Republic's coronation as Emperor of Central African Empire, which cost 25% of the country's annual budget, was paid for by France. And as a favored friend of the West, Mobutu Sese Seko built his village palace, the so-called Versailles of the jungle, with its own private runway for his Boeing 747 for use for quick shopping trips to Europe while the West looked away. In South Africa, Hendrik Verfoed, brandishing his anti-communist credentials, promulgated his hardcore racist apartheid ideology protected by Western powers. And in Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser won over his Soviet friends to fund his Aswan Haidam mega project to the utter displeasure of their Western rivals, still upset about losing control of the Suez Canal. As such, the sovereign African big men that I will be discussing in these lectures were not only the product of their societies, they were pawns and agents of the NATO and Soviet power blocs. And that is why the end of the Cold War also marked the beginning of the gradual disappearance of the most spectacular species of the continent's sovereign big men. Let me note briefly how I see my line of inquiry in these lectures relate to the landscape of modern and contemporary African art history. There is a measure of scholarly consensus on the role of art and artists in the production of national cultures during the African independence decade. Quite apart from the fact that the generation of artists joined by their peers in the professions, public administration, educational industry, and others, sought to establish institutions for the new nation, they also participated in the articulation and production of new national cultures, art discourses, and related institutions. But one major area of inquiry that preoccupied leading artists, writers, and critics on the continent was language. That is, the place of indigenous and colonial languages, art, and design in the making of post-colonial literatures and arts. For visual artists, a major thrust of their work was in the recovery and redeployment of indigenous art forms, techniques, and aesthetics, often in combination with elements of European modernism, to define what I called post-colonial modernism in my 2015 study on Nigeria during this period. Ibrahim El-Salahi, who is the subject of my fourth lecture, was a major figure of this period. However, in a recent work, I argued that what distinguished contemporary African art from post-colonial modernism is its rejection of the latter's cultural nationalism and, in terms of its political posture, the adoption of critical and even oppositional view on post-colonial governmentality. This schema is largely still defensible, but there are two important caveats. First, by foregrounding the role of post-colonial modernists in the establishment of post-independence national cultures, I do not suggest that they all invariably drank the liberation Kool-Aid, thoroughly lost in the euphoria of sovereignty and formal invention, so much so that they failed to see the early signs of coming sociopolitical crisis. Indeed, what I hope to show in these lectures is that in some cases, the same artists, like Gazbi Asiri in Egypt and Ibrahim El-Salahi in the Sudan, who participated in the making of post-colonial modernism, became critical of the national project as their nations slid into periods and cycles of autocracy. That is, one might say, they moved from the modernists cultural nationalism to contemporary artists' skepticism and critique of the national projects in the course of their careers, thus alerting us to the fact that the two categories are neither diachronically fixed, nor are they exclusive to one or other generation of post-colonial African artists. The second caveat with my earlier schema concerns the multiple trajectories and pace of African decolonization and art histories. While the years between 1956 and 66 have been aptly described as the independence decade, several other countries decolonized before and after this, thus complicating the location of post-colonial modernism only in that momentous 10-year period. Not only that, debates about national culture by leading writers and artists that marked the high noon of post-colonial modernism did not register as prominently, if at all, in many parts of the continent. For instance, political conditions in the 1940s and 1950s South Africa limited debates about national cultures to a network of privileged white artists such as Walter Battis and Eduardo Villa, while the absence of a sizable black educated class and autonomous art industry there in South Africa and in the Congo at independence ensured that black artists from these countries were largely absent in the continental and Pan-African critical and cultural networks of that period. Thus, the clarity of our view of modernism, for instance, in Nigeria, Kenya, Senegal, Sudan, Ethiopia, Egypt, Morocco, and elsewhere at mid-century, fails in other parts of the continent. Given this reality of African decolonization timelines, the different contexts of art practices and discourses, the study of the relationship of art and power, of the artist and the big man, offers a different, and I hope productive, perspective on the history of modern and contemporary African art that indeed has continental salience. We already know from Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, from Argentina to Brazil during the military dictatorships, that autocratic regimes have either embraced art and artists for the work of propaganda or suppressed them when they resisted co-optation or were made by artists from victim groups. What is not as clear in the historical record is how African post-colonial governments, especially in the era of the big men, estimated or responded to art's possibilities as a threat to such regimes. For sure, in South Africa, where Hendrik Verfoed, a Nazi sympathizer, had articulated his idea of what constituted good national art, we are not surprised that his regime hounded white artists whose work seemed incompatible to his ideology. Given all the above, how might we explain why in Nigeria, during the military dictatorships, for instance, anti-establishment art had its finest moment without evidence suppression by the regime? It was so bad at the time that this work was shown about 100 meters from what used to be called Dodden Barracks, where the military head of state lived. And journalists were too worried and afraid to look at this work or even come close to the space where it was installed for fear of being arrested. But nothing happened to the artists and the work itself. So how do we explain this phenomenon? And we have similar scenarios in Egypt, the Sudan, and the Congo. So the question is then, Did these regimes misrecognize art's symbolic and critical power and thus oblivious of the threats posed by artists? How was it that the same apartheid regime that prosecuted white artists paid little attention to the powerful works of Dumile Fenny that I will show rejected Fefood's idea of good art? And did Mobutu Sese Seko not see in the outrageous ultra-modernity of Bodie's Ise Kingelezi sculptures a mockery of his nationally imposed authenticity program? There's one question that haunts these lectures and for which I might, alas, not have a convincing and final answer is this. Why were fine artists who did not meddle in other sorts of direct action or ideological work largely absent from the long lists of political victims of African big men, given their record of violence against perceived opponents that frequently included musicians, writers, dramatists, and photojournalists? Is it simply a matter of fine art dependent on an intimate connection to the ruling class by an umbilical cord of gold, as the American critic Clement Greenberg once put it? Or let's put it this way, did fine art, often presented in government spaces and foreign cultural centers, or in private galleries run by the social elite, and therefore not accessible to the masses, seem less threatening to the big men, regimes, and interests, regardless of the ferocity of its critique of power? In the next few weeks, therefore, I explore the work of artists across the decades of African independence, during which sovereign post-colonial governmentality, whether nominally democratic or evidently despotic, was held in thrall by sovereign big men. And I do this to show the different formal and conceptual tactics devised by these artists to reckon with or meditate and reflect on the sociopolitical transformations of their societies as they experienced the euphoria of decolonization and strained under the weight of oppressive and corrupt governments that evolved around the continent in the second half of the 20th century. We shall examine different varieties of big men from Egypt, South Africa, Sudan, Nigeria, and the Congo, who typified post-colonial governmentality in Africa from the 1950s, when decolonization of the continent began in earnest, to the end of the 20th century. And in the context of their tough political practices and the crisis-prone social worlds that they engendered, I will examine exemplary work of Gatsby Assiri, Dumile Fenny, Ibrahim El-Salahi, Obiora Udechukwu, and Isaac Bodie's Kingeles, and frequently those of their contemporaries, in order to construct, hopefully, a fresh, but by no means comprehensive account of art and politics in 20th century Africa. Thank you.